From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Rabbi Jack Moline, filling in for your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support, and for more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sunday is the Christian Feast of St. Valentine, celebrated universally as a day of romantic love. And Monday brings the Buddhist and Jain Nirvana Day. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, what a difference a state makes. Everybody said it was the evangelical Christian vote that powered Ted Cruz to win the Iowa caucuses. This week in New Hampshire, not known for faith-driven voting, Donald Trump took the lead, with Ohio Governor John Kasich in second place. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders caused Facebook to explode with the words, "I told you so," repeated more often than Marco Rubio saying Obama's destroying our country on purpose. One interesting historical note, when the current president won office in 2008, the social media savvy senator from Vermont didn't even have a Twitter account. New York has joined a growing list of states, including Hawaii and New Hampshire, working to ban ex-gay therapy for minors. LGBT kids are already safe in New Jersey, California, Oregon, Illinois, and the District of Columbia. But sadly, Oklahoma is at the forefront of attempts to protect ex-gay pseudoscience and its practitioners. Still a long road ahead of us on this, folks. And meanwhile, in Georgia, lawmakers are working overtime to pass the most restrictive so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act in the country. There are at least 8 different versions of this act that are being considered, and each one is worse than the one next to it. Opposition includes business leaders, a bipartisan coalition of cooler heads, and many, many others. But misleading rhetoric about religious liberty often takes on a destructive life of its own, which is why Interfaith Alliance is making these state-level mini-RFRAs such a priority in the coming year. And now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Flint is having a humanitarian crisis of international proportions because of a single botched policy decision by the state that wrecked the city's lead pipes and lead poisoned the water and lead poisoned the town.
Many see the ongoing water crisis in Flint, Michigan, as the perfect storm of racism, far-right public policy, environmental indifference, and economic injustice. Even worse is the fact that Flint may be far from alone in dealing with this kind of long-hidden, man-made health crisis. Later in the hour, I'll be joined by Sam Fullwood, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Please welcome the Colbert Report Chaplain, Father James Martin. Father Martin!
Now, if I help the poor, what's in it for me?
Other than eternal salvation, you mean?
Or? Yeah. What's my immediate payoff?
With the Christian season of Lent having started this week with Ash Wednesday, and Pope Francis having raised the profile of Roman Catholic teachings in discussions of world affairs, this seemed like the perfect time for an interfaith conversation with the author of the new book, 7 Last Words, An Invitation to a Deeper Friendship with Jesus, written by Father James Martin. A prolific writer and popular public speaker, Jim will be with us later in this hour. But first,
too many people take their interpretation of the Bible to be the thing that everybody should live by. And they have to have more respect for other people's dignity. I think you know in a lot of areas where people are devout, fundamentalists, there's a real anti-gay attitude.
Entrepreneur and activist Mitchell Gold is a leading voice in denouncing anti-gay hate disguised as religion in this country and defending its most vulnerable victims, particularly young people. So when reports of a surge in young LGBT Mormons taking their own lives hit the headlines recently, we felt it was essential to have Mitchell back on the show. Mitchell Gold, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's nice to be here.
So listen, there were some concrete statements that the LDS church leaders made a few months ago that some are connecting to these tragic events. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Well, it's interesting. When I did my book, Crisis, about young people and what they go through when they realize that they're LGBT, one of the things that really struck me is I spoke to there's several Mormon people in the book, as well as I had spoken to many several others. And I will tell you that I know 12 gay Mormon men, and every single one of them attempted suicide. So I don't know how many gay Mormons I don't know, because they took their lives before I ever got to meet them. But it's a very harsh way of growing up. And when you are told that you are not good enough to be in the church, to be married, when you grow up in a usually large family and the church is a very central part of their life, it's devastating to these kids. And it's one of the things I talk about all the time, that I've come to the conclusion now that I've been an activist for more than 15 years, that when a religious institution, be it Orthodox Jew or Muslim or Christian, teaches that homosexuality is a sin, quote-unquote, that is devastating to a kid that's brought up to believe in the concept of sin. So I am really working hard to try to get religious institutions to stop that teaching.
So we know that last November, in particular, what the LDS Church did was to brand participants in same-sex relationships as apostates and deny their children baptism, and furthermore, demanding that those children, if they wanted to remain in the church, disavow their parents when they turned 18. Is there anything that the Mormon Church has done that made this kind of declaration particularly hurtful, because it seems to be consistent with their policy all along?
Well, the Mormon Church has been at the forefront of anti-gay behavior. I mean, they were one of the really strong ringleaders in the original California ballot initiative to deny same-sex couples, loving same-sex couples, the right to be married, the rights and the benefits of marriage. They were at the forefront of it, and they have been at the forefront of a lot of the laws throughout the country, a lot of the marriage amendment battles to be against the gay community. And the one thing I would say about the Mormon Church is, you know, really, who are they to be a moral authority on anything, given their past performance with women, the way they treated African-American people? I think one of the things is that in America and in large parts of the world, people who speak from a religious point of view are given a pass, because it's like, oh, well, that's their deeply held religious belief, so we have to honor that. I think we have to stand up and say, no, we don't have to honor that. And whether it's Mormons or Southern Baptists or Orthodox Jews, you know, who are these folks to pretend to have moral authority when they have caused so much incredible harm to people? And this is very real harm that happens to young people. Not just suicide, they suffer very high rates of depression. They're 8 times more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol. There's a lot of attempted suicides. I mean, it is crushing for a kid to grow up in this environment.
So I know that you're not a faith leader, and so I can ask you this question in a way that would be more difficult to ask someone like me, for example, a rabbi. If there's someone who belongs to a religious tradition that does not affirm their sense of self, would you commend to them trying to change things from within, or would you suggest that they throw up their hands and walk away?
Well, it's a good question, and I am known as suggesting to people to change from within. I really believe that you owe it to the other friends of yours in that congregation to share with them the truth of what's happening and the kind of harm that they are causing, because so many of these folks are not mean, horrible people. But the unintended consequence of them trying to be faithful to their religious traditions causes a great deal of harm. And very often when they know that and understand it, people change. I mean, there's been a significant change in America in the last decade of people's attitudes towards LGBT people. I'll point out that Reverend David Gushee from Atlanta, he changed his position and he wrote a book. And he's written in the Washington Post about it, as well as many other places. Reverend Tony Campolo, big leader of the Independent Baptist Church, he's changed his position. So I really recommend to try and change from within. However, if you can't change it from within, then at some point you really have to leave, because one of the things is you don't want your children growing up in this environment. And Jane Clemente, whose son committed suicide about 5 years ago, jumping off the George Washington Bridge, I had recommended to her to try to change the church from within. And then she finally said to me, you know what, I just can't. And I had to leave because I don't want to be part of this toxic teaching to young people. And she delivered a big speech in Kansas a couple years ago that basically said, try to change it from within, but if you can't, leave, because you don't want your children growing up in that toxic environment.
I know,
and toxic is a perfect word for it, too.
I know you have a lot of experience talking to people individually about this in a different tradition they might call witnessing about it. Would you tell us the story of maybe someone in your own sphere of influence whose life and attitude was changed because of a conversation you had?
Well, probably the most significant one is David Gushee, who I spoke to about 8 years ago when I first came out with the book Crisis. And he, at that time, and still does, teaches ethics at Mercer University and is a well-known evangelical pastor. I mean, he, when I first talked to him about the harm that's caused from his teachings, he was a little taken back, and that began to be the seed of his changing. But right in my community where my factory is in Taylorsville, North Carolina, which is Alexander County, we've just recently gone through a situation where the high school now has a gay-straight alliance. Now, this is a county of 38,000 people, 14 traffic lights. It's a dry county. It doesn't serve alcohol. Beautiful rolling mountains and over 100 churches. This is not your typical community that would all of a sudden have a gay-straight alliance at the high school. But they do. The Board of Education backed it. The town people, a lot of the town people backed it. Now, there were some ministers in particular who were very vocally against it. But the exciting thing to me was after that all happened, I got calls from people on the Board of Education, from county commissioners, from other people in the community, just random people, a retired school principal, that said because of my outspokenness and because of the conversation they had with me 2 years ago, 5 years ago, that it really caused them to rethink what they were being taught and to change.
It's a wonderful story and really a wonderful piece of evidence about the power of one person and willingness to have a difficult conversation.
I think that's the big thing is a lot of people don't want to talk about religion. They're afraid to. And I think that it's a conversation we have to have. And you know, the one thing I want to say is over the years of doing this now, I have met more Christian ministers, clergy, than I ever knew my whole life. And one of the really rewarding things of what I'm doing is how many people I meet who don't want to cause harm, who want to do good things, and who use their scriptural teachings or their faith traditions to embrace people and to include them and to love people and not to find a reason to put themselves in a superior position to somebody else so that they can be better than.
So let's dig into that a little bit. There are resources that are available to people, and in the LDS Church, for example, the Mama Dragons, who try to connect mothers of LGBT Mormons with each other, and Affirmation, the International LGBT Mormon Support Group. Do you know of other resources that are available for these kids who are at risk?
Well, one thing is, you know, it's so easy to go online today. And we actually have a website called faithandequality.org. It's not a website that asks for contributions or anything. It's purely a variety of faith leaders as well as lay people, parents, who speak out and say, you know, I do not believe homosexuality is a sin. I affirm and embrace you. And Reverend David Gushee's on there. I can't remember who the rabbi is that's on there. But there's many different people on there, and Jane Clemente, mother of Tyler Clemente, is on there. So that's a really great way for kids to go on and realize that they're not alone and there's a lot of other people. I don't know of a particular Mormon group that they could reach out to affirm to in person that meets or anything, but there's so much online now that's really open to them.
So what do you think is the most important thing that a faith community can do for its LGBT kids?
Well, I think the most important thing is to make sure those kids know that they believe that that child is whole. Not love the sinner, hate the sin. Not, oh, I love you, you know, I wish you weren't this way, I wish I was going to have grandchildren, or, you know, crazy things like that. But it's really to let a kid know from day one, when that child is born, that whatever they turn out to be, if they happen to be transgender, if they happen to be lesbian or bisexual, whatever, or straight, that they are loved and considered whole and not broken.
Unconditional parental love, it's a message that is part of every religious tradition, certainly that's part of Interfaith Alliance.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, some people take that and say to their child, well, I love you unconditionally, but I think you should go to a Christian counselor to try to stop being gay. I love you unconditionally, but, and there cannot be any buts afterwards when it comes to sexual orientation. I think when people are having children, one of their obligations is to really understand totally sexual identity, sexual orientation, gay, straight, whatever it is, so that from day one, their child can be loved and fully whole.
Amen.
Yes.
Mitchell Gold is co-founder of the Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams Furniture Company, a tireless human rights activist. In 2005, Mitchell founded Faith in America to raise awareness of the damage done by anti-gay rhetoric disguised as religious doctrine. Mitchell, you are such an incredibly important voice on these issues. Thank you so much for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
For many years, it seemed like when Roman Catholic leaders engaged in the broader culture, it was to take the conservative side in culture wars. But the tenure of Pope Francis has changed that. Speaking out on issues of social and economic justice, he has positioned the church as a defender of the marginalized in a way that many have found refreshing. As Christians marked the start of the pre-Easter Lenten season this past week, I thought it would be interesting to spend a little time at the intersection of Scripture and society with Father James Martin. He's just published a book titled Seven Last Words, An Invitation to a Deeper Friendship with Jesus, based on Father Martin's homilies at New York's St. Patrick's Cathedral on Good Friday in 2015. Jim, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, too. So listen, having seen you with Stephen Colbert, as well as elsewhere, I know that you have a particular ability to translate scriptural concepts for a more heterogeneous audience. So my first question to you is, the Jewish practice of Midrash brings a personal value to a sacred text. Is there a personal value or set of values that you bring to these sacred texts?
Well, sure. There's a kind of Midrash that we do as Jesuits. St. Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order, which is a Catholic religious order, invited us to imagine ourselves in the texts, imagine ourselves in the Bible stories. And so it's a kind of special way of praying. And, you know, as a result, you get your own personal sort of take on the Bible stories, and you get your own personal insights. But, yeah, you know, as Christians, we are encouraged to, you know, read the Bible stories and make them our own. And, you know, it is the, as Christians and Jews believe, it is the living Word of God. And so, you know, God still speaks through those words. So absolutely.
So can you tell me one of the values that you might bring yourself to this process?
Well, for example, that very notion that God wants to, you know, address me through Scripture. And, you know, also the idea that, that you know, Christians believe that Jesus Christ is risen and alive. And so Jesus Christ himself wants to communicate to me through Scriptures. And that includes the Old and the New Testaments, you know, the Hebrew Bible as well as the Gospels.
Terrific. So I want to ask you the same question twice in two different contexts. What are the ways you see the relationship that Roman Catholics have with Jesus as particularly applicable to interpersonal relationships?
Well, that's another great question. You know, we relate to Jesus, of course, as our Savior and Messiah, but also as our brother and our example. So we believe that Jesus is fully divine and also fully human. And you know, not only do you know that Jesus is helping you in your relationships with other people, but he's an example. He's a model. And so on the most basic level, you know, he's a model for charity, for forgiveness, for trying to give people the benefit of the doubt. I always tell people also that Jesus met people where they were. He spoke to them in their own languages. He used simple things for their parables to help communicate God to them. And so that's a call for us, too, as Christians, to meet people where they are and to take them as they are, just like Jesus did.
It's great. Now, you see, I read the book, obviously, as a non-believer in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I wasn't vested in a deeper relationship with the person of Jesus. I still found a lot to enrich my personal spiritual life. What do you hope the skeptic will take away from reading your book?
Well, I hope the skeptic will see that Jesus was a real person and that Jesus went through the same kinds of experiences that we do. On Good Friday, when he utters those so-called seven last words, the seven last phrases that he says on the cross, we see a person who's suffering physically, which we all know, emotionally, I think, because he's abandoned by his disciples, and also spiritually, too. He has that really profound cry, my God, why have you forsaken me, which is preserved in the original Aramaic and Hebrew, depending on the Gospels, that shows that he suffered spiritually. He felt a distance from God the Father, and that's something that I think most of us encounter in our spiritual lives.
So, Jim, would you talk about the ways that Pope Francis has managed to extend this message of his faith to a universal audience, including a secular audience? How important is it to be able to do that in today's world?
It's extremely important to do that, and Pope Francis is trying to lead the way. From his very first meeting with journalists a few days after he was elected, he said, I ask you to pray for me, and if you're not believers, just send good thoughts my way. He says that many times. He's reached out to, the Jewish community. He went to a mosque recently in Rome. He is meeting with the Russian Patriarch during his visit to Cuba, and so I think more than almost any other pope, save Pope John Paul II, who really made efforts in terms of interfaith relations, he's really trying to do his best. And he includes, I think, even more so than John Paul and Benedict, agnostics and atheists, because, he's a religious leader, but, he's also a world leader as well.
Can you tie that in a little bit with the Jesus of your book?
Well, the Jesus of my book and the Jesus of the Gospels meets people where they are. One of my favorite stories is Jesus going up to Peter by the Sea of Galilee and saying the familiar words, come after me and I will make you fishers of people, or fishers of men in the old translation. He literally travels from Nazareth to the Sea of Galilee, which is about 40 miles, and he doesn't speak to them as a carpenter would. I mean, Jesus is a carpenter. He doesn't say, come after me and we will, build up God's house, or come after me and we will construct a new way of living. He says, come after me and I will make you fish for people. So he's literally going to where they are. He's meeting them where they are in Galilee. And he's also speaking to them in a language that we can understand, that they can understand. And that's what the Pope is trying to do. And I think that's what we should do with our brothers and sisters, to hear them as they are and to meet them where they are.
It's really important to remember that the stories that we tell as scriptural happened in real life before there was a synagogue, before there was a church. And it's we who've taken them inside these institutions. So I'm wondering about this. I love it when religious teachings escape from the confines of a house of worship and into the outside world. You created this series of talks as homilies. How did they change when you put them into a book that was for general consumption outside the walls of the church?
Well, one thing is that I had to be more careful about explaining things. The people who would come to a Good Friday service, are mainly people who would understand something about the Catholic faith. And so I was very careful to explain the Christian faith, to explain what it meant that we believe Jesus is fully human and fully divine. And most especially to explain how the Gospels were constructed. People tend to think that, the gospel writers were reporters on the scene that had a notepad or a tape recorder, and that's simply not the way it was. There was Jesus' public ministry, then there was this oral tradition, and then there was the writing down of the gospels. And so people need to understand that before they can understand what's in the gospels, and that's one of the things I try to talk about in the book.
So I loved at the beginning of the book where you said that your fellow Jesuits were a little concerned that people were going to have to listen to you seven times.
Yeah, right.
But I'm not concerned about that at all, because you have a great way of expressing some very complex ideas in ways that really touch the heart. Father James J. Martin is a Jesuit priest, a writer, and editor-at-large of the Jesuit magazine America. He appears frequently in the media and is the author of numerous books, most recently, Seven Last Words, An Invitation to a Deeper Friendship with Jesus. Jim, I've enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure, and I'll say toda.
Alo davar, as we say in Hebrew. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
The horror of what has happened in one American city in the 21st century is not diminished by the fact that it all unfolded in slow motion. Flint, Michigan, a poor, majority black city, has been poisoned thanks to decisions made regarding that most basic of resources, its water supply. For a look at the forces that contributed to this disaster, I'm joined in the studio by Sam Fullwood III, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Sam, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Happy to be with you today, Jack.
So would you start, please, with a brief summary of the events in Flint for those listeners who may not be familiar with the details of this awful situation?
Residents of the city noticed something odd about their water and complained to city officials who, strikes me as inexplicably, didn't take it seriously. And people complained of the water smelling bad, looking bad. They later complained that it was causing physical reactions, hair falling out and rashes and those kinds of concerns with them children and with themselves. And the mayor even went on television drinking the water, telling people it was safe. Eventually, the complaints mounted to the point where they had to be taken seriously. And now we're at a situation where they've tested the water. They found that there's abnormally high levels of lead, and it's caused great international concern about both public officials and their ability to respond to a need, as well as just an environmental crisis.
So I'm not interested in defending any of the public officials. But with everything going on in this world environmentally and viruses that are popping up, how did the residents figure out that it was the water and not some other cause that was making them sick?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I'll have to plead ignorance on that. I know that eventually the water was tested. And once it was tested, it became impossible for people to deny that that was what the problem was.
And was there a point of responsibility that you can indicate of the first level that fell down in responding to this crisis?
Assessing blame is always very, very difficult. What we have here is systemic breakdown. At almost every level. Now, initially, the residents of Flint complained to local officials. Let's go back a bit. What actually happened was in this community, they decided to substitute their source of drinking water from one lake to another. This was done as a cost-cutting move. They had an alternative source. And that's the first problem. People complained early on that this might be a problem, but money ruled in this particular case. And so you had local officials making a decision about the source of really money rather than environmental safety.
So the city itself has fallen on hard times. It used to be a much more prosperous community. How much of this is about the poverty that's in Flint now? And how much of this do you think is about race, since it's a predominantly African-American city?
We're getting into speculative territory here when we start talking about race, environmental racism. I'm inclined to believe that poor people's lives do not matter as much as more affluent people. This isn't because they are poor or because they're black. It's because they don't command the respect of the levers of authority in a community. So to the degree that you have people who probably are going to be more reactive than proactive in most cases, public officials will do what they do because they're not getting the pushback in ways that matter to them, if that makes any sense.
It makes sense, and it's also a very powerful argument for engagement in the political life of
absolutely,
a community.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think that the more poor and racial minorities, ethnic minorities, religious minorities are engaged in our political process, the less likely they are to be overlooked in situations like this one. And I think that that's where the problem really lies. Yes, Flint is a majority African-American community. It is majority poor. Its citizens do not carry the same kind of weight across Michigan that some of the more affluent communities do.
And is this a problem, Sam, that is unique to water, or does this apply to other public resources?
I think a point that we really need to be aware of is that Flint is not unique. There are places all across this country where environmental degradation is disproportionately influencing the lives, the welfare of poor people. I'm thinking more in terms of the Delta in Mississippi, for example, where you have a long history of environmental degradation affecting a community that doesn't get the attention that it really should. The situation in Flint is particularly egregious and it's grabbed headlines, but we have infrastructure needs all across this country. I mean, we are not making investments in bridges, in sewer lines, in water pipes, in transportation. All of these things disproportionately impact communities of color, poor people, and Flint is one that we are paying attention to now.
How would you characterize public response outside of Flint to this crisis?
There's sort of a mixed bag of public response. I mean, we're in the middle of a presidential campaign, so just 2 days ago, Democratic nominee hopeful Hillary Clinton went to Flint to dramatize her concern about this. Clearly, it was a political move as she's seeking to shore up her bona fides in the South with African-American voters. So this was a way of sort of showing her concern on that. I've seen stories about athletes. Flint is where not very far from East Lansing, where Michigan State plays basketball, one of the top-ranked basketball and football teams. And the athletes there have generated concern and attention to it. Politicians, like I said, have paid attention. But I don't know that this has really seeped into the consciousness, say, in Washington, where policymakers are dealing with these issues. I'm not so certain that that rank-and-file Americans, average workaday people, are talking about Flint in a serious and profound way. I don't get the sense that the resources that are needed to sort of solve that problem. In fact, the legislation that's being working its way now has run into some questions about how will the money be spent without really thinking about the people that are involved in it.
So those of us, like me, in the faith community, like to think that we have the ability to activate large groups of people to cry out against moral crises in the country. And yet, there hasn't been much activism on the ground generated by faith leaders, at least as far as we can tell from the headlines. Is it, as Kevin R. Dendulk wrote in the Washington Post, that there's been a puzzling silence among faith leaders?
You probably have a better handle on how faith leaders are grappling with this. I think I've paid a little bit more attention to the political side of it. I think we are living in a time in America where we are a lot more reactive than proactive. And I think that reactiveness is proportional to the amount of concern raised. There's not a lot of concern about what's happening in Flint with its water supply. I think that as that gets ratcheted up, we're going to see politicians, faith leaders, and everybody else be more concerned And I think that's unfortunate that we have to be reactive to these kinds of things. President Obama has often spoken about the need for infrastructure investments, and he has sort of cast this as Americans sharing concern for other Americans. That sort of speaks to the faith idea, the moral component of citizenship, if you will. That has gone nowhere in our society. And to the degree that faith leaders and politicians and average, you know, walk-a-day citizens are not outraged by these things, speaks to that.
So much of our national infrastructure dates back to a period of time in which there were more people available for this kind of work and more money that Congress was willing to devote to it. And I think a lot of America has gotten used to having an infrastructure in place that they presumed didn't need any attention. And now as these things begin to fall almost in a domino effect, there is almost a sense of panic when something happens here, there, or in another place. Is there a way to approach in a more methodical fashion the repair of our national infrastructure?
I got two thoughts about that. You're so right, Jack, to point out that there was a period when America did invest in the infrastructure, and it was viewed as putting Americans to work. That period, and if you think back, you know, think back 100 years and 50 years ago, the people who benefited from government investment in infrastructure, building roads, highways, bridges, were viewed pretty much as white male family people. Over the last 50 years, we have seen political forces recast the role of government as helping special interest, and often cast as helping minorities, so that it becomes a very bad thing to spend public money on building roads because you're going to be putting the wrong kind of people to work. That is the subtext of what we hear. We know what can work in some of these situations. We need an economic development plan for these kinds of things that would be an investment in building our infrastructure. But that seems to be politically unpalatable.
And we're sitting here in Washington, D.C. having this conversation. And not too far from here in Northern Virginia, there are communities that demand that if developers are going to come in and build housing developments, that they have to provide the infrastructure. Of course, in order to do that, they pass along the price to the consumer, which immediately leaves out affordable housing and accessible facilities to people who can't pay those premiums. Is there any way around that?
Well, I think citizens have to be engaged. I mean, we mentioned this a minute ago. If citizens who vote, if poor citizens, if minority citizens who are disproportionately impacted by these zoning types of restrictions say, no, we won't stand for this, and we will throw out the people who are doing it, and we will vote in people who would do differently. That's the way our system is designed to work, and it has to work with all the people sort of putting their oars in the water at the same time.
So what's the way for our listeners to engage on a policy level around this issue? What would you recommend as two or three steps that a person listening to this conversation might take?
First of all, I think you have to be aware. You have to inform yourself about what's going on. You have to know what's going on in Flint as well as in your own community. And then you have to be able to make your voice heard to the policymakers both locally and federally about what you think ought to be done, particularly interjecting some sense of morality into the lawmaking process. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that. That's not saying the same thing as interjecting religion. But there is a difference between saying this is right and this is wrong. It is wrong for government to turn its back on the infrastructure in a community and poison its people. And I think also you have to vote. And once you've informed yourself, once you've raised your voice, then you can go out and find the politicians and the people who to do what you think needs to be done.
Is there any message of hope that we can deliver to the people of Flint?
Well, I think that already the attention that has been generated is provoking some change. I think we have seen government officials stop the stonewalling and stop denying the problem and attempting now to redress it. I think that's a hopeful sign.
I remember the scene toward the middle of the movie Erin Brockovich, where she was also trying to get the water cleaned up in a community. And she pours a glass of water out of a pitcher for the attorneys representing the other side, tells them where it's from, and sort of dares them to drink. That's a turning point in the movie, and maybe it's a turning point for Flint as well. Maybe we just need to send a glass of water around to all the politicians.
If it were that easy as it is in Hollywood, then maybe some things would get done a whole lot faster.
There you go. There you go. Sam Fulwood III is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he analyzes the influence of national politics and domestic policies on communities of color across the United States. Sam, it's a terrible story, but I really thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and giving us a sense of where we need to go.
I was happy to be here, even if it was a terrible story.
Before we go,
I'm very angry because our country is being run horribly, and I will gladly accept the mantle of anger.
Pundits have been quick to define the economy as the source of the voter anger, feeding the Trump and Sanders campaigns.
Ask the American people, and more than half of them will tell you that they are mad as hell and not going to take it anymore.
What are they so angry about?
It all kind of varies on what they're upset about. Some are actually upset with the president. Others upset with the House and Senate.
Our country is being run by incompetent people. And yes, I am angry. I'm very, very angry.
There is a climate of outrage in our country that ought to cause concern for anyone, but especially for people of faith. And when I say faith, I don't limit the term to people who are religious or even to those who consider themselves believers in God. Instead, I mean those of us with a worldview that includes a measure of hope. A long time ago, when I was about midway through my career as a rabbi in a synagogue, I had the opportunity for a sabbatical. I want to commend sabbaticals to you. I know that there are few of us who can afford to step away from the rigors of work for an extended period of time. But it makes sense that our bodies and spirits require renewal and replenishment no less than the good earth. And from the Bible to environmental science, a regular time to lie fallow is a requirement to nourish the land. Our lives and our souls are no different. It had been almost 18 years of pastoring a congregation when I stepped away for a refresher. For me, it had been way too long. And only as I reaccustomed myself to a pace of life that was not frenetic did I discover an awful truth. The energy required to care for and care about the dear people in my communities was immense. I always slept well, and I attributed it to a clear conscience. But I realized that the more likely explanation was that I was simply exhausted, and not just physically. To protect myself, I think I had cauterized my emotions. It became more and more difficult for me to feel anything. What kind of a life is a life without feelings? It is no life at all. And so somewhat unintentionally, I went in search of feelings. Now, don't get me wrong. I was part of a loving family and a supportive community. But the strength and gentleness of love, joy, and gratitude were not up to the task of penetrating the shell that I had constructed around my tired old heart. Only one emotion had that power, and that was anger. Anger had the capacity to pierce the numbness and allow me to feel again. And so I became something of an anger junkie. I looked for outrage all around me. My messages to my congregation were filled with passion and indignation. Injustice surrounded me, and I was drawn to it like an addict. But you know what? Like a drug, the rush was temporary. And like an addict, I thought I was fooling everyone by being so high-functioning. I was giving off a lot of heat, but not producing very much light. Taking a few steps back, was the only solution. I committed myself to a sort of emotional rehab. At the end of that sabbatical, I pledged to myself that I would not ignore the warning signs of relapse, and that when I recognized myself slipping into destructive obsession, I would take stock, count my blessings, and find a place of perspective. And here I am to tell the story. We have 9 more months until this new election season completes its gestation. The anger that has animated so many candidates for so many offices and so many of their supporters is a reflection of the exhaustion of the American soul. The problems we face as a nation are no less critical than the problems we face in our own lives. But neither are the blessings of America any fewer. It is time for everyone to take a deep breath and a step back so as to recognize the difference between heat and light. Faith is the way to achieve that sense of groundedness. The values we hold, whether they flow from the depths of our hearts or the scripture we hold sacred or the teachings of a beloved mentor, give us hope. And not the hope that is a magic wish, but the hope that is an affirmation that tomorrow always holds the potential to be better than today when we seek the good and not the outrage. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. I'll bet you know at least one person who would be interested in hearing what you've just heard. Share State of Belief with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online, too. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Help us to continue the good work we do not only over these airwaves, but in communities around the country and in the nation's capital. I'm Jack Moline, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. It's been my pleasure to be with you this week. Be sure to join Welton Gaddy next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics here on State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what